You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Support for today's show comes from Google Play. Did you know that you can now download and listen to audiobooks on Google Play? That's right. With hands-free listening using Google Assistant or Chromecast, you can enjoy thousands of titles a la carte, no subscription necessary. There's even multi-device integration across the Google ecosystem. And for a limited time, you get $10 off your first one by visiting g.co/play/kick. That's g.co/play/kick. Find your story with audiobooks on Google Play. And now, enjoy the show.
It was discovered my wife had a brain tumor. I'm not even making this up. It was removed. She's great. Everything's good. Thank you. I didn't remove it. I was in the other room soiling myself. I joke around, but it was scary. We have five children, and there were moments when I was like, oh my gosh, if anything happens to my wife, those five kids are gonna be put up for adoption. I did some shows in China. You visit some places and you think, all right, there's a language barrier, but I could get by. In China, I was like, oh, if I got lost, I would die here. I can't believe cross-country skiing's even a sport. Hey, you know that awkward part in downhill skiing where you're trying to get over to the lift? What if we just did that?
That was a clip from comedian Jim Gaffigan's sixth hour-long stand-up special titled Noble Ape. In it, the funniest man in comedy gets personal as he discusses the medical crisis that hit his wife and family this year, almost leading to his retirement, as well as awkward massages, ancestry tests, and the worst fruit of all, grapefruit. Jim is one of my personal favorite comedians, and I've been wanting to have him on the show for ages, so I'm thrilled to finally have him on the podcast. Today he opens up about his wife's brain tumor surgery, their unique comedy writing partnership, and how she was the first person to suggest using her brush with death in his stand-up act. Jim reveals how trial and error led him to his own authentic voice as a comedian, how he gets inside the head of the audience and plays his own worst critic on stage, and why he's making fewer and fewer jokes about eating. He discusses why he's breaking free of the Netflix model for his latest comedy special, and why he's taken a number of dramatic roles in no less than 13 films coming out this year. Plus the mixed blessing of Hot Pockets, the worst part of a colonoscopy, and the hardest gig in the world, opening for the Pope. Coming up with the hilarious Jim Gaffigan in just a moment. Comedian Jim Gaffigan has a new hour-long special called Noble Ape out in theaters, on demand, iTunes, Amazon, and myriad other digital platforms. Jim Gaffigan, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
The beard looks really good.
Oh, well, thank you.
Is this new?
My wife hates it. Thank you.
I'll bet.
This beard is something I've had kind of off and on.
Yeah, because I remember I saw you probably not that long ago at the Ace Theater.
Yes.
And I don't think you had the full beard back then.
No, I didn't.
Are you and Letterman maybe doing some kind of beard contest right
no,
now?
No, it's weird. Deal? I did this movie in New Orleans where I had to have a crazy beard, and then I got and I had a Skype with this director of this movie I'm coming up, and he's like, "I really like that beard," and I'm like, "Okay," because it's just out of control.
Yeah.
That's almost a little bit creepy. Because I'm supposed to play like a widow who's kind of distraught. Yeah. He's like, yeah, that's it. You look like a mess.
Well, I am a longtime fan of yours. And like I said, I just saw you at the Ace probably, I don't know, a few months back. I absolutely love this latest special, Noble Ape.
Thank you.
I think that it's, what, your sixth hour-long special, right?
Yeah, six-hour special.
It struck me as a turning point. I mean, you talk about... your wife's brain tumor, you talk about family stuff, personal stuff, less food humor, zero Hot Pockets jokes.
Yes.
Did it feel like it was maybe an evolutionary leap for you as a comedian?
Well, you know, maybe, possibly. I mean, most creative people kind of set, you live on self-assignments.
Yeah.
And so I knew that I was making a shift away from food. I think in Cinco, like the first 45 minutes didn't have any food, but
yeah,
still the last 15 minutes did. Yeah. So, but this one, I wasn't kind of thinking like, I'm not going to do food. I was thinking more like I wanted to do a couple stories, which I did with the Pope story and the gastroenterologist. But, and of course, the brain tumor thing was not planned at all. That was just, dealing with real life, emergencies and being thrust into this strange environment emotionally and physically, 3 weeks in the hospital. So just writing around that, not in the moment, but like, you digest things, obviously, once we knew we were through the woods, then I could try and look back and try and make some humor out of it.
Yeah, it's a little hard to go back to donuts after your wife almost died.
Right. It is. But there's also something very cathartic about chronicling that period and kind of, because hospitals are weird places, you know?
Oh, yeah.
And, almost losing your spouse is a very terrifying and weird experience. So,
yeah, she was in there, what, I think you said like a month she was in critical care or something?
Yeah,
like that.
Intensive care. So it was, and then, the recovery, people go through, something I learned is that I think as a society, we kind of go under this belief that sickness is kind of like you have a cold and then the cold is gone and you go back to work when, severe illness, there's lingering effects. I mean, my wife is probably at 80%. Of energy that she was. I mean, she's still herself. But it's pretty amazing. I mean, that 80% is far more vibrant than I've ever been in my life.
Yeah, but it is a process. And
yes.
I mean, it must have given you a lot of time waiting in, probably trying to distract yourself any way you could from what was going on. You must have had a great opportunity to kind of observe the crazy carnival of humanity that is the hospital.
Yeah, I mean, it is. I mean, that being said, out of respect to caregivers, and maybe some of it is my coping mechanism, because we have five children, so much of my time was spent organizing and caretaking this situation. My wife, essentially did everything. And so I had to, in that role of also be the caregiver who, if you've ever had someone in the hospital, it's like another job.
Yeah, so, you had to snap into action.
Yeah.
I heard that at one point you almost considered retiring from comedy for a while.
Well, I definitely viewed... I had to look at scenarios, and there was probably a good 2 weeks where I was like, you know what, this is probably it. Even if she survives, the likelihood is that she's going to be limited in her capacity to go about everyday life. And so because the tumor was on the cranial nerves that control swallow and, speech, so I didn't want to... If I was going to be a single parent or the partner of someone who is medically, you know, debilitated. I couldn't really see, like, and now I'm going to do shows in Cleveland and Toledo. Yeah. You know what I mean? It's, I didn't want to outsource the parenting, obviously, too.
Yeah, yeah. And we've seen how hard that transition's been for Patton Oswalt.
Yeah.
And I mean, he got back into comedy, I think, what, like a month or two after he lost his wife.
Well, you know, I called Patton, you know, because I was like, look, it doesn't look good. I don't know Patton that well. And he was like, you know, he's so supportive. He was like, look, what you have to understand is there, you can get help, you know, you can get, you know, nannies and stuff like that. And I'm like, Patton, I have 5 kids. You know what I mean? It's like, know, we already
nanny
have
would
help
take that on.
And a super mom. So, but he was so supportive and, you know, it was nice to talk to someone, but you talking about him going to comedy, it is, you know, because I feel like most of Noble Ape is me kind of organizing some of that fear and that drama that I dealt with.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, I wrote it with my wife, too. Obviously.
Right. Now, you're kind of like me because you have this beautiful wife who probably works out and is very thin. And you and I are less so, let's say. It's after you had kind of gotten through this at some point, did you ever want to tell her, told you so? See where exercise and healthy eating gets you?
Oh,
you know, I'm still standing.
No, you know, it is, it's really interesting because right before, because I had seen a cut of Chappaquiddick, you know, so this happened last April.
You were great in that,
by the way. But I saw how big I had gotten. And so I had seen that at probably, I want to say maybe February. It hadn't gotten into Toronto or wasn't just distributed at that point, but I was like, wow, I really gained a lot of weight. So I had, in February, I had gone to like, I'm gonna get back into shape, and then of course this happened, and you know, my old friend food was the only thing that, you know, like I was you know, in the hospital for 12 hours or traveling to and from the hospital, so I gained probably like 20 pounds in that. You know, like I wish I was one of those people that in tragedy they can eat, but I can eat whether I'm happy, sad, whether there's, you know, food or not. Yeah. I just am always eating.
Now, when you began working this material into your act, at some point did you have to sit her down and ask, hey, is all this stuff fair game?
Yeah, you know, it's weird. There was a green light of discussing it because, you know, you have to understand comedy is, and there's obviously a level of respect, but my wife, you know, we weren't thinking we would have this special where we'd talk about this, but she came out of an MRI. At one point they had to, you know, they do an MRI, which is, and they were building like a map of her brain so that they could do the surgery. So she was in this MRI for, I don't know, felt like a day, but it was probably 2.5 hours, and she came out, and I was, you have to sit there and do nothing in the MRI, and she's, you know, the first thing she said to me, she was like, write down these ideas I had about MRI. So she had comic ideas about the MRI, and I was like, I don't know if that's necessary at this moment, but so that was before, you know, different surgeries that
I mean, it must be kind of weird because you're probably used to her looking out for your health, and the roles are reversed.
Yeah.
At one point you talk about, I guess she convinced you to go get a colonoscopy eventually.
Yes.
I have one scheduled for September because, you know, they schedule them out so far in advance.
Yeah.
First one.
Yeah.
Is it as bad as everyone says? What's in store for me?
It's, you know, it's pretty surreal.
Okay, I can handle surreal.
It's pretty surreal, but I think it's the day before that's the most awkward.
The drink?
The drink and the not eating. And just, you just have like, you know, they have to empty your system.
Yeah.
So that is just surreal. And so going through that, you're a little bit like, you know, I mean, we've all been sick. We've all had diarrhea. And, but you're like, for an entire day. Like, your instinct is like, should I probably eat salad or something?
Yeah.
But you can't.
Wow.
So it's just a strange experience. Yeah.
I mean, that sounds like the kind of diarrhea that killed people in the 1800s. You know?
Yeah, yeah. It's, but it's important to do it because, but what I've heard is that the technology on that front is changing where you're going to be able to mail in a piece of your poo.
That would be nice. Apparently, it's not changing quickly enough for me.
It's not changing quickly enough. I hope someone's eating while they're listening to this.
Inevitably, they will be. We were talking about how you and your wife write together and work together. She also was the co-writer and I think the co-producer with you on the Jim Gaffigan Show, which I just, frankly, I want to say I absolutely loved. There are too few comedies that have heart on TV these days. Was it strange writing and producing with your wife this show that's pretty closely based on your life and having an actress who isn't your wife playing her on TV?
Yeah, it was very strange because I'm playing Jim Gaffigan.
Right.
I'm writing the show with my wife, Jeannie Gaffigan, but someone else is playing Jeannie Gaffigan. And so then we have to write for that actress who has a different skill set than the real Jeannie Gaffigan. I mean, every actor is different.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, no, it was fun. It was very rewarding, but it was also, in the end, after two seasons, it was one of those things where you can't, on a biographical show that captures your relationship with your wife, you can't really outsource that. You can't sit there and go, you know, like,
You can't have a team of writers writing
about your
life.
So it has to be grounded in some, you know, like every character, you know, like Jeannie's friends, you know, like the Daniel character was based on a lot of friends. But it has to, it can shift because it's Michael Ian Black. But, you know, my wife, you know, this woman's portraying Jeannie. So we have to keep it in the guidelines of who Jeannie wants that to be.
I feel like so much of what I think that I know about you is actually from the TV show. So I'm not sure what if I'm asking you questions about you or the TV show. For instance, you play your own dad in the show. Was that pretty accurate to the man?
It was an exaggeration.
Okay.
I would say my wife, Jeannie Gaffigan, like the episode that you're talking about, it's the episode's called The Mike Gaffigan Show. But it's on her website, GeannieGaffigan.com. So if people want to check that out. But it was fun because, and then my son played me.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And it was directed by my wife. And by the way, that whole episode was written by my wife because that was a compilation of stories she had heard me tell about my dad and about, you know, there was a tornado and they forgot me. So she kind of compiled it and, but it was pretty surreal to play that role. And I watched it recently. I think I showed a friend. And it's weird because it's an exact, I mean, it's a comedic portrayal of him.
Yeah.
It was not that bad. But
he is sort of the Mad Men generation.
Yes.
Had a drink when he got home. And what was he, a banker, I think?
He was a banker. Right. And the 10-year-old version of me probably saw him like that.
Oh, yeah?
So played by my son, where it was, he was very stern. It was a different era.
Yeah.
You know, like it was, you know, there was like just a different set of roles. Like, you know, it was, you know, sure, we, our reference point is Mad Men, but it's even different because I think that fatherhood has changed so much. You know, like he was a rather liberal guy, but for his era, do you know what I mean?
In Indiana, like, right?
Yeah, and he was, you know, he had done, you know, things where, you know, like I think in the bank, he made sure that the, you know, the first vice president that was African American, he fought everyone and made sure that this guy was the first African American vice president. You know, it's like, it's kind of stuff that was, you know, it's a long time before Obama. The things that you know, I'm very proud of.
Yeah. Now, speaking of Mad Men, I read that when you first came to New York and you were working on becoming a comedian, you worked in advertising. Is that right?
I did work in advertising.
Did you learn some things that were helpful in comedy, like, I don't know, economy of words,
yes,
and that sort of thing in
advertising? I think economy of words, efficiency of a statement. I mean, not that like advertising people would go, yes, that's one of our thing, efficiency of statement. But yeah, I mean, I think that most importantly, I had the opportunity to be a copywriter and I was an account person, which is kind of the businessy guy. And if you've watched Mad Men, so I was different roles. And, you know, mostly I learned that I didn't like it. I learned a little bit, but, you know, it was I was not raised where the entertainment industry was a realistic pursuit. Like, even going into advertising was a little bit out of what someone would do from my background. Yeah. And that's not to say that I came from a fancy background. My father was the first one to go to college, but it was, you know, you would seek security, and advertising is not secure.
When you were starting out, who were some of your mentors or some of the people you looked up to?
I started in New York City, and, you know, my peer group was me, Greg Giraldo, Judah Freelander, Ian Bagg, Bonnie McFarlane, and then other friends that, you know, I don't know. I don't know what happened to some of them. But who I really respected was there was this group of really good comedians that were probably, they'd probably done it maybe, I don't know, 3-4 years before me and my group. And they were just unbelievable. They were Louis C.K., they were Dave Attell, they were Todd Barry, they were Mark Maron, Sarah Silverman. And so, like, there was just this gauntlet of really good comedians. So I learned a lot from watching people of that generation. Like, I think that's probably the most important, you know, from my perspective, comedic generation.
Now, everyone you just listed probably couldn't be more different than you are. Right. I'm guessing back then, in, you know, the 90s in New York, your act probably went against the grain.
You know, my journey to finding my point of view or my voice is very kind of it's kind of like going back to the beginning.
Yeah.
Like, I started off, my first time doing stand-up was very kind of monology, kind of what I'm doing now. And obviously, Dave Attell, there's an irreverence and there's an anger there. And so I tried on a lot of different hats.
That's
of
what I was
styles.
Wondering if there was some experimentation before you kind of landed on your persona.
Definitely. There was time when I tried to do political material. There was time when I did voices. There's times when I hopped around on stage. There's times when I would smoke cigarettes on stage.
Really?
That's
hard to picture.
All filthy jokes. I tried everything. And then I ended up going back to who I was at the beginning.
Really?
So it just took a while. I mean, I had enormous stage fright, and I think that I never really came from a performance background. I remember looking at all these guys that, like, I just wish I was Jewish so I could have a bar mitzvah, because I always imagine they all killed it their bar mitzvah, and now they get to...
Yeah.
They have their first performance. Like, I... but so I was... I think it took me a long time to get comfortable. I still feel like, you know, I feel like I'll look back 3 years ago.
Yeah.
And just my ability to tell a story has gotten so much stronger.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with Jim Gaffigan when we come back in just a moment. Hey, guys, I want to tell you about Dollar Shave Club. Dollar Shave Club delivers everything you need to look, feel, and smell your best. You name it. Shampoo, conditioner, body wash, toothpaste, hair gel, even body wipes. Dollar Shave Club is my one-stop go-to for all of my toiletries, and I've especially become a huge fan of their Amber and Lavender Calming Body Cleanser. It smells absolutely fantastic, and it's a great way to get your day going. But all of Dollar Shave Club's products are great and made with top-shelf ingredients that won't break your budget. Plus, shipping is free with your membership. And here's a great way to try a bunch of Dollar Shave Club's products. For just $5, you can get their Daily Essentials Starter Set. It comes with body cleanser, One Wipe Charlie's, their amazing wipes, their world-famous shave butter, and their best razor, the Six-Blade Executive. Keep the blades coming for a few more bucks a month, and add in shampoo, toothpaste, or anything else you need. Check it out at dollarshaveclub.com/kickass. That's dollarshaveclub.com/kickass.
Did you spend your night tossing and turning? If so, I feel your pain. Literally. Chronic back and neck pain have led to many a sleepless night for me. And even worse is that feeling when you wake up all stiff and achy. That's no way to start your day. I talk a lot on this podcast about the importance of getting a full night's sleep. It's vital to your physical, mental, and emotional health, and even your overall longevity. That's why I want you to know about Purple Mattress. Made with brand new material that was developed by an actual rocket scientist, the Purple Mattress will feel different than anything you've ever experienced. Unlike traditional memory foam, the Purple Mattress is both firm and soft, so it's supportive yet comfortable. Plus, it's breathable, so it sleeps cool. That's a big one for me. And with their 100-night risk-free trial, if you're not fully satisfied, you can return your mattress for a full refund. Not to mention, it's backed by a 10-year warranty with free shipping and returns. Folks, you're going to love Purple. And right now, our listeners will get 10% off your entire order in addition to this week's free gift with the purchase of a mattress. Just go to purple.com and use my promo code KICK at checkout. That's purple.com, code KICK. The only way to get 10% off plus your free gift if you use code KICK at checkout. One more time, that's purple.com, code KICK. How do you stay up to date with the latest business news? If you're still relying on traditional news outlets, keeping up with the news feels like a chore, but it doesn't have to be that way. Business news can be enjoyable, even something you actually look forward to. How? It's called Morning Brew, and it's a free daily email newsletter that delivers the latest business news directly to your inbox every weekday morning. The writers at Morning Brew curate the top business stories that you should know about and deliver them in a conversational and witty tone. Best of all, it's just a quick 5-minute read. Seriously, imagine getting all the information you need to start your day in just 5 minutes and enjoying every second of it. I know how overwhelming it can be when you've got so much news coming at you every day, and that's why I subscribe to Morning Brew for my business news. I love that it's concise, easy to read, and even entertaining, a great, fast way to get the most essential business news before I head into the office. So what are you waiting for? Sign up for free at morningbrew.com/kick. That's morningbrew.com/kick to start getting your daily dose of business news. And now, back to the show. When you're at the level that you're at now, where you're playing large theaters, even Madison Square Garden, do you ever still have bad nights? Just feel like the audience, you know, just wasn't 100% on board, or does the fact that they're paying $70 to come see you kind of insulate you against that?
Yeah, well, I would try to make it be 70. That's probably New York or LA,
right?
You know, there's something about when I'm doing a theater or a larger venue like touring, that I am so caught up in making sure that everyone leaves there saying that was great, that I try and make it kind of undeniable that it'll work. So in other words, I'm not unprepared.
Yeah.
I've been doing it forever. So yeah. I know what to do and I know what's going to work. And my style is, I'm not going for home runs. I'm going for single, mm-hmm. double, triple, home run, single, you know, like it's kind of a relentless style and I do care about, everyone having a good time, not absolutely everyone, but generally.
Well, yeah, I did notice last time I saw you that just at the very end, you give them maybe like 5-10 minutes of Hot Pockets. Is that obligatory? Will they riot if you don't do that?
You know, it's like you have to understand that it's so strange because there are certain kind of like conventionally held beliefs in comedy. And one of them is people come to a show and they want new material. Mm-hmm. And you should be evolving, getting better, and you want that material to be A. And one of those conventionally held beliefs is that there's no greatest hits. There's no Stairway to Heaven. There's no, like, I just want to hear him sing that song. There's none of that. But that being said, from my experience, the Hot Pocket thing, there's a little bit of... you know, I'll look at the audience and there's varying ages sometimes, and it's sometimes there's younger kids, sometimes there's 12-year-olds, and, you know, I know that I'll kind of clean up, like the 12-year-old will have a good time, or there might be a person here or there that, like, really just wants to hear that. I mean, they want to hear a fresh perspective on it, but it's weird because it's like there's part of me that's like, I almost want to apologize for doing it. I don't resent doing it.
You don't?
I don't. It's, you know, you want people walking out of there going, that was great. That was, you know, there's money, but it's also time. That was worth my time. I came here and we got the whole experience.
Yeah. You know, from my perspective, kind of outside looking in at comedy, it seems like people are very, perhaps more so than other arts, other mediums, are very quick to try and pigeonhole someone, a black comic, political comic.
Yeah.
You, of course, get pigeonholed as a food comic
or as a
clean comic.
Yes.
Do you bristle at those kind of labels?
I do, but I also know that, you know, that's the entertainment industry. And it's also, look, it keeps the expectations low.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, I think any comedian would just want to be the only adjective they want is funny, right?
Yeah.
Whether they're, you know, any kind of segmentation, how we break up people. But it's weird, you know, like, but some of it is like, you know, the clean thing. I'm like, yeah, I guess I am clean. But I also feel as though that's not what is, you know, people will say it's nice. I can listen to it while I'm with my very religious grandmother. But that's not why someone is paying $50 to go see a show, to just hear someone not curse. Like, we don't live in such a cursing-filled era where it's like, it's an amazing experience. He talks for an hour and he doesn't say fuck.
But in comedy, you know? It really is an accomplishment, I think. I mean, to get a consistent laugh every 30 seconds, every minute, the way that you do. I mean, I don't know other comedians other than maybe John Mulaney who packs as many laughs into an hour as you do and do it completely clean without cheating, without saying the F word.
You know, it's,
it's a huge accomplishment.
Yeah, but I think it's also stylistically authentic to me, or Mulaney.
Sure.
Do you know what I mean? Just as, it's not a language thing, but like if you would ask Lewis Black to not be upset about politics, it would be weird. It's authentic, him being angry about the political situation, people bond through that. Or Chris Rock, if he wasn't saying curse words, you'd be like, that seems inauthentic.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Dave Attell, you know, if he didn't have to be irreverent, and it were, you know, like there's so many different styles of comedy. I don't think we know how to kind of group them. You know what I mean?
It's no, for sure.
It's fun. But you know, in a way it's like, as long as I keep getting better, which hopefully I am, I also know that labels are limiting.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, all that matters to me is that someone's funny. And I
like
a lot of different kinds of comedy.
Right.
The audiences don't have to be pigeonholed, and neither does the comic.
But, right.
You know, fans will know your hallmark is that you do this kind of inside voice commenting on your act. I wonder, what's the origin? Was that just you putting words to the confused faces you saw in the audience? Or how did you come up with that?
Well, that was the inside voice, which is talking for someone else.
Yeah.
Is something I've done since I was a teenager.
Really?
I remember.
In what context?
I think it was just talking for someone else. Maybe just being nervous in front of a girl and just talking and just like, oh my God, Jim Gaffigan. You know what I mean? So it's always been a defense mechanism. And so what happened, I didn't initially do it in my act, but I started to, you know, in the 90s, criticizing, you know, like Johnny Carson used to go on stage and essentially professionally bomb. Like he would say a joke and he'd be like, oh, that one didn't work.
Yeah. And then he'd have the savers ready.
Yes. And so that worked on The Tonight Show. That did not work in New York City. Because in New York City, 90s New York City, any sign of weakness You know, you have to understand, in the early 90s, you know, this is before YouTube. This is before, there was no Netflix. There was no, you know, there was essentially specials on HBO every now and then. People didn't know how to really, now 12-year-olds are you know, incredibly literate on comedy. And so, essentially, I was a slow-talking Midwesterner, this odd kind of, you know, and so in that time, I interpreted my, you know, everyone was very, you know, your ethnocentric identity was pretty common. So it's like, I'm a black comic. I'm Italian. My mother's Jewish, da, da, da. And so like my ethnic identity was Midwestern, was white, pale Midwestern.
Okay. Well, but you kind of won the lottery because you got the broadest ethnic identity that would work in those days.
And so anyway, but what happened is I would be up there. And so these rather tough New York audiences that you have to understand, the reason Bill Burr is the brilliant comedian he is because he's Bill Burr. But also like that C's mentality or that kind of sense of combat is very Northeastern United States comedy, early 90s. And so what I was this slow-talking Midwesterner, so I would say a joke, and I would, you know, and so, like, because it was such a eat-or-be-eaten environment, I felt the need to keep talking. So I would heckle myself rather than have the audience heckle me.
Interesting. So it's kind of almost like your version of an or something.
Yes, it would be.
A pause.
It's also, you know, it's just keep talking.
Yeah.
Because I'm moving slow. I'm not talking about wildly irreverent things. But I think the fear was if I stop talking, someone else will say this. And it's also, it communicates a level of intimacy with the audience. Like, I'm aware that I'm doing a lot of jokes on this topic. Or I'm aware of what I look like. You know, it's a conversation with a friend, with an audience.
One thing I always wonder with comics, especially ones who do these hour-long specials, how do you know what to finish with? Do you just always finish with whatever you think is strongest or what?
I'm of the opinion that it's individually to that hour. You know, in Noble Ape, it's typically you start autobiographically, I think. And then you learn something. It's like you meet someone, you tell them your name. It's very autobiographical. And then my whole thing is, you know, the speed or the pacing of the punchlines would be more till the middle. And then at the end, your relationship with the audience is such that you can be more open. And so that Pope story is you know, they know me, they know my sensibility. I've proven to them that I'm funny, so I can tell you this story of where I probably wasn't my best. And so they've learned different things about me that led up to why I got the Pope gig, that I was unprepared, that why it might be funny.
You also talk about traveling, and you do something that I didn't really realize until I watched the special, is you actually tour with the whole family. Even you guys go overseas together. Doesn't that just add layers of stress that you don't need when you're trying to tour?
It does. But, you know, for me, I don't want to... I want to do some international travel, but I also don't want to be away from my kids. I want to do a lot of stand-up shows, and I don't want to be away from my kids. And so typically spring break, summer break, we used to go on a bus tour on spring break and summer break. But spring break, summer break, say President's Day weekend, typically a destination where I'll do shows that might be interesting for my kids. You know, maybe it's skiing or maybe it's we're in Paris and I'm doing a show in Paris. It's amazing. I mean, I don't make any money, but I get to do a show in Paris and my kids get to go to Paris.
Do you have any energy to actually do anything with them by the time you're done working?
Oh, yeah. No, it's usually, I mean, it's...
You have the whole day, I guess. Huh?
I mean, I'll, you know, like say we were in Paris and I did, the show was at the end. So we arrived on Thursday and then we had Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and then the show was Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe it was, yeah, the show was Sunday and they had to fly back. And then I did some other European shows.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, I think that in here you talked about you went to Japan with the whole family.
Yes.
I wonder if you had the same experience that I had when I went there. I love Japan, but it seems to me like it's almost a carbon copy of America, but slightly different in the strangest ways. It's almost like, you know, everything that would be lame here is somehow unbelievably cool over there. And everyone is incredibly nice, almost to the point that, you know, it's like walking into a cult. It's off-putting. Yeah.
No, I mean, I was in Japan for a couple days, you know, and I mean, I loved it. It's just, I mean, some of it is I'm such a nerd for going to other cultures and kind of discovering. And I feel that way. I mean, look, I feel that way in Texas. Mm-hmm. I feel that way in, you know, Georgia, in northern Florida is different from southern Florida. And even if it's just, you know, some of it's me eating the food, but
it's a big part of it.
Fascinating. You know, I mean, I love history and culture and stuff like that. And the international thing, it's great to get a juxtaposition on, you know, a comparison on how things are done. And then that presents mm-hmm. the question. So like in the UK, they don't say there is no exit sign. It says way out. And you're like, if anything, America should say way out and the Brits should say exit, right? So there's things and you're like, well, it makes you think, well, why is there a sign?
It's always the little differences that stand out with me for some reason. It's not the huge cultural differences if I'm in Saudi Arabia or somewhere like that strikes me. Your publicist here, he sent over some notes before we did this, and he says apparently you have 13 feature films that are going to be released in the next year. Is that true?
It is true. It's my God. Some of it is... I would say probably over the next year and a half.
Okay.
But some of these are, it's not like every blockbuster. It's a lot of them are indies. Some of them are animated.
Okay. So and they may have been sitting on them a while.
Absolutely.
Trying to find
so like the animation movies, they take like 10 years. Mm-hmm. So you're like, wait a minute, when did I do this? So like Hotel Transylvania, that started a long time ago.
Okay.
And so some of them are that, and some of them are just, you'll do an indie and it'll float around. Some go to festivals and some will float around. And I think one of the Alec Baldwin movies coming out in the fall. And that was done, I think, before I did Chappaquiddick.
Oh, really?
So it's
Chappaquiddick was great, by the way.
Never know when they're going to release it.
How much of you packing in all these movies into the next year is just maybe you trying to scrub audiences' mind of the image of you being the guy who poops with the door open on Sex and the City?
It's, you know, a lot of these roles, I'm thrilled to get the opportunity. Like, I've wanted these roles, you know, for 30 years, and I just never got them.
Yeah.
So it's not like I was turning them down or any... you know, tactic behind it. It's just you don't have control over timing in the entertainment industry. They're like, now we'd like you to do this. You're like, oh, well, I was gonna do this. You know, it's like that whole thing in the entertainment industry. If like you want to get a job, just plan a vacation. Exactly. You know, that's what happens.
And you chose not to go to the Netflix route with this latest special. Yeah. Noble Ape is out on all kinds of different platforms and mediums. It seems to me that with comedy, every generation has their gatekeeper. There was Johnny Carson, then HBO, Comedy Central, now Netflix. Do you think that maybe we're getting to the point where it's less of a monopoly?
Well, I think I view it a little bit different. I from my experience, I think there are the gatekeepers of comedy, which Johnny Carson, David Letterman, and I think Comedians in Cars is kind of that right now. But I also think then there's the distribution of comedy, which I think Comedy Central really changed the whole landscape when they started doing our specials. I was the beneficiary of that. That was at the perfect time.
Yeah.
before gaming was huge, before streaming services were as prominent. So back when I, in 2006, when I did Beyond the Pale, you know, Comedy Central was on in most dorm rooms. So I got an hour special.
Yeah, that was their heyday.
And that just transformed my life over 6 months. And so then I did King Baby, and it was still Comedy Central. And then there was this period where Louis did his self-distribution. I did self-distribution and a couple other people. And then Netflix came on. And so for Noble Ape, I was presented with a couple different options from people that wanted to distribute it. One of them was Netflix. But at this present moment, I have five specials on Netflix. So I was like, I don't know if I need to go to Netflix with this one. I do love that because Netflix is international. Netflix has been very good to me. But what I found appealing about the people that are distributing Noble Ape is it's available to everyone at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So people that like to download things off of Apple and Amazon, so people that like to watch things on their Xbox, so people that like to watch things on demand.
And movie theaters
and audio.
Mm-hmm.
So like with Netflix, what was happening is there was a buffer, sometimes 6 months, before you could release your album. Mm-hmm. And so some of it is, I get a lot of plays on like Spotify and stuff like that. So it was.
That's probably how I found you, believe it or not.
Really?
I think I was listening to some comedian and Jim Gaffigan. I was like, oh, he's the pasty guy who talks about food. I don't know if that's my thing. And then within 5 minutes of something that was suggested, I got hooked on you. And I've been a fan for, God, years now.
Oh, well, thank
and
you.
And I think it really was Spotify.
Yeah, no, it's amazing. I mean, I think of all these places to consume comedy, and they've all, in their own special way, have like changed my career. Like, I feel like satellite radio has changed my career. I feel, obviously, Comedy Central, obviously, you know, Netflix, obviously, Apple, you know, iTunes, and Amazon, too. So it's amazing. So that's when it was presented to me. I was like, okay, let's try
do
that.
Them all.
Yeah. I mean, also, they paid me that help.
Well, before we go, now I'll ask you about opening for the Pope. Sure. How do you even begin to prepare for something like that? What kind of material works in that situation?
Well, that's the thing. The thing is that it seemed surreal leading up to it. I was like, so they were like, they're coming to your Atlantic City show, the people that are hosting the Pope, and that you're going to be, do you want to host the open for the Pope? I'm like, yeah, obviously I'm not going to open for the Pope. Thinking like, you know, they're going to eventually come to their senses and go, maybe not a comedian.
Yeah.
You know, maybe, you know, Bocelli, you know.
AC, what were these mob-connected
Catholics? No, well, they were Philly. Philly people. Okay. So they came to the Atlantic City shows. And so they're like, yeah. And so eventually, as it got close, there was all these press interviews. They're like, you're opening for the Pope. Are you nervous? Are you going to prepare? I'm like, yeah, I'm definitely nervous. I'm definitely going to prepare. But I never prepared.
No.
But in some situations, there's no win situations for some stand-up comedy. So, like, even if I had, I mean, not that, like, anyone would see me if I killed at the Pope. It's not like people would be like, you know what? The Pope was cool, but that comedian, he was great. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not going to compete with the Pope.
Yeah.
But there's also something of, you know, there's situations in comedy where it's just a no-win situation.
Yeah.
No one, you know, like there are voluntary participants that go into a comedy club for a stand-up. People are going to see the Pope and maybe see some Catholic music.
Yeah.
They're not there
not
for
Jim
jokes.
Gaffigan.
They're not... They're not aware of my sensibility, or even if they are aware of my sensibility, there's going to be people that's not edgy enough, and then there are people that are going to be like, that's way too edgy. The Pope's about to come on. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's just an impossible situation.
Yes.
And how many people were there?
I think they said 1 million.
Wow, I mean, the pressure of working Madison Square Garden, comics always talk about how you know, it's impossible to work a venue like that. I can't even imagine 1 million people.
Yeah, I mean, you have to understand the entire city, because of course I brought my kids to that.
Okay. Well, that's five people who came for you then.
Yeah.
And I assume your wife, although yes. She's the Shiite Catholic, so maybe yeah. She went for the Pope.
No, she was there. But like we arrived the night before because we live in New York City. And it was like you couldn't get into the city because the Pope, they'd shut down so many streets in Philadelphia. Yeah. I was like, is this necessary? But it was that level of security.
Yeah, got to protect the Pope mobile.
Yeah.
Well, so you didn't do hot pockets for the Pope?
No. And the Pope, it ended up where I essentially opened for the Pope mobile. I did stand up, and then the Pope Mobile drove in.
Well, Noble Ape is out in theaters, on demand, iTunes, Amazon, and wherever you like to watch. Jim Gaffigan, thanks for talking with me.
Thank you.
Thanks again to the amazing Jim Gaffigan for coming on the podcast. His stand-up special, Noble Ape, is available in theaters, on demand, iTunes, Amazon, and all of your favorite digital platforms. There's even an album as well. Just a few of Jim's upcoming live dates include the Borgata Spa and Casino in Atlantic City, August 4th, Santa Rosa, California, August 9th, and the Iowa State Fair, August 14th. For Jim's full tour schedule and all things Gaffigan, visit jimgaffigan.com. Support for today's show comes from Google Play. Did you know that you can now download and listen to audiobooks on Google Play? That's right, with hands-free listening using Google Assistant or Chromecast, you can enjoy thousands of titles a la carte, no subscription necessary. There's even multi-device integration across the Google ecosystem. And for a limited time, you get $10 off your first one by visiting g.co/play/kick. That's g.co/play/kick. Find your story with audiobooks on Google Play. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on iTunes and leave us a review. You can follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at Kick-Ass News Pod. And as always, I welcome your comments, questions, and ideas at comments@kickassnews.com. I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.